Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to do your own reading around the topics we discuss.
Hello and welcome. So we've got a really great podcast lined up for today. I'm really excited to have a guest speaker with me, Caroline Liebus, who is a consultant at Cambridge. She's also got a postgraduate in medical education and does clinical communication skills facilitation at the university. But the reason she's here today, I should say, obviously, she's an acute physician like all the best people. But the reason she's here today is we're going to talk about learning disability. And Caroline was involved in the setting up of the toolkit. So sorry, Caroline, stumbling over my words already this morning. And I think you're the one that's been on call all weekend, so I've got no excuse. So Caroline, welcome. And do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself and why you've got an interest in learning disability?
Yeah, thank you, Vicky. And I'm very excited to be here. So thank you for inviting me to this podcast. We see a large number of patients with learning disabilities in acute medicine, and they really do comprise a vulnerable group. And following the Equality Act in 2010, it is actually now the law that reasonable adjustments are made to ensure that these patients get equitable access to healthcare, but also that they get good quality of care. Unfortunately, we know that this is sadly not the case. For instance, the Learning Disabilities Mortality Review in 2020 showed that 48% of patients with learning disability experienced substandard care, and this is really something that we need to address. And the toolkit for the acute medical care for people with a learning disability was launched in April last year. And I'm delighted to have been a part of the working group for this. And hopefully through this podcast, we'll take you through the main sections of that toolkit.
Yeah, so I've gone through the toolkit and it's a brilliant piece of work, and it's so well written and it's so well set out, and it's common sense and it's easy to follow. And it's like all those things, you know, with the toolkits, they're just great. But some of the statistics in there were really shocking, like patients with learning disabilities die 20 years younger than their peers. And you're talking about the substandard care. Why do you think that is? And are there any groups in particular that are at higher risk?
Yes, it's really devastating, Vicky. So the median age of death for people with a learning disability is 62 years old, which is significantly lower than the background population. And men die on average about 23 years younger than their peers, and women about 27 years younger than their peers. It's likely to be multifactorial. Patients with learning disabilities have significantly more comorbidities than the baseline population, and on average have about 11 health conditions, in particular autism, neurodevelopmental delay, epilepsy, dementia, and mental health difficulties. About 40% of deaths are due to pneumonia, and this is probably because many of them, about three quarters of them, have dysphagia, which, as you know, can lead to airways obstruction and aspiration.
So that's really important for us as acute physicians, isn't it? So I think that's something that really stood out to me. And I was thinking, well, do I think about that when I'm clerking patients? Am I actually, you know, if they come in with a pneumonia, am I thinking about aspiration? When they first come in, are we, you know, assessing their swallow and making sure that it's safe for them to have whatever the tea lady in a busy ED is just handing out? Is there anything you found, you know, practical we can do in those situations? Because they are probably just going to get offered whatever the tea lady's got without thinking about that.
I think the main thing when somebody first presents to the emergency department or the medical assessment unit is to gather as much information as you can and try and front load all you can about them. Often they'll have a hospital passport with them, which lays out lots of helpful information about them, including their swallowing and what they can and can't eat. The community and the hospital learning disability teams can be very helpful, as can the patient themselves if they can verbalise, and if not, then their next of kin and their carers. So it really is getting as much information as you can as to their usual baseline. Mm. And then, of course, if they do have difficulties with swallowing, getting the speech and language therapy and the dietitians involved.
Yeah. And when these patients present, often it can be sort of non-specific. So are there any top tips in sort of looking for things in those patients?
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought that up, particularly the soft signs are probably another reason why patients with learning disabilities die younger, because their diagnoses and illnesses are picked up at later stages. So as you said, they often present with non-specific symptoms. So it's just being really aware of this. So for instance, if they have malignancy, they may not be aware of their symptoms. If they have pain, they may not verbalize that as such, but they might just show a reduced appetite or altered sleep or a change in their normal behavior. Many of them have constipation and suffer with impaction. If they get delirium, again, it may just be a change in behaviour, which may be difficult for you to pick up if you don't know what their baseline is, or they may have altered ability to carry out their activities of daily living. And another thing which is more common in patients with learning disabilities that maybe as medics we don't think about is foreign bodies, unfortunately. So very, very important to check all orifices.
Okay.
And the difficulty is that there's a real risk with these patients that we assume that their behaviour is due to their learning disability. And this leads to a phenomenon called diagnostic overshadowing, where the patient is assumed to be acting that way because of their disability and not due to an organic illness. And that's something that you really need to try and avoid.
Yeah. And this... Do you think that sometimes as physicians, especially if we aren't don't have a close loved one who's got a learning disability, do you think sometimes we're a bit frightened to address these patients because we don't know quite how to? And if they've got sort of behavioural issues, we struggle with that. Do you think sometimes clinicians avoid that a little bit and try and get in and out as quickly as possible?
I think so. But actually that works against you, because if you don't make an effort, you're not going to get the information that you need, and therefore everything's going to get more complicated. So it's a little bit like teaching medical students that they need to ask open questions before closed questions, because although it feels like the consultation's going to take longer, it's been shown that if you ask open questions first, then the overall conversation is done more quickly. So the more effort you do put in at the beginning, the better position you'll be in to treat them. And there is nothing to be frightened of. And hopefully throughout this podcast, we'll cover a few more top tips as to how to manage these patients.
Yeah, I think probably just re-emphasising your point about the passport. Yeah, that's a great place to start, isn't it? Because it's got so much information. And if they haven't got one with them, then, you know, find out where it is and see if you can get it. So I thought what we'd do now is just use a case of a patient that I saw a few years ago now, who it really resonated with me and I learned a lot through it. And I thought it'd be quite useful to discuss it, because we could look at the different learning points as we go through. I saw a 62-year-old lady who had a severe learning disability. She had microcephaly. She had very little communication, no verbal communication. She was on some medications. She was on promethazine and escitalopram. And she lived in a residential care home, but her next of kin, who was a sister, visited very regularly. And she attended because the care home staff and the family were just really worried about her, because there'd been a huge change. Because usually this lady loved her food. It was one of life's massive pleasures for her. And she wasn't eating. She was vomiting intermittently, but very agitated. The GP had wondered whether this may be a urinary tract infection and treated her with some trimethoprim, but that made no difference whatsoever. It was really difficult. And the first consultation, there was no observations apart from they'd managed to get a pulse and a count her respiratory rate, but that was about it. They couldn't get a blood pressure and they couldn't examine her. So her pulse was 110, her respiratory rate was 28. And that was as much as they had at that point in time.
Yeah, so it can be really challenging when the patient has little verbal communication, as in your case. Depending on the definition or which sample you look at, we know that patients with learning disabilities have communication difficulties in about 50 to 90%. And this can range from mild limitations to being completely nonverbal. And unfortunately, this leads to reduced access to public services, breaches of human rights, reduced quality of care and end-of-life support, and increased mortality. And is also associated with other deficits in sensory systems, such as hearing and visual deficits. So again, it makes it more difficult to pick up the soft signs and the non-specific symptoms such as altered sleep pattern or oral intake. And often these patients become very distressed or aggressive or agitated. And that can be their way of communicating physical illness, but it's often just perceived as unacceptable behaviour, which, as we've said before, can lead to diagnostic shadowing. So tips that we have, again, are to talk to the people that know them to ask whether there are any ways that communication can be aided. And there are various tools that you can use. We tend to advise avoiding distraction, speaking very slowly in short sentences, asking if the patient is anxious or in pain or angry, and describe and show them what you want them to do. Now, this obviously varies on the patient's level of understanding. Mm-hmm. And in some patients, you can't even do this. But with some patients, it may be that they can respond to communication aids. So Makaton is often used, which is a series of signs and symbols to depict common words. And the Abbey Pain Scale is particularly helpful. So it uses vocalization and facial expressions and physiological and behavioural changes to grade the severity of pain, even if the patient can't verbalise it themselves.
Okay. So I think I alluded to this before when I was sort of saying, do you think people might, you know, not spend as much time because they just don't feel like there's anything they can do? In this case, it looked to me like when you're reading through the notes, that was all that happened on day one. On day two, there was a ward round, which was to give more sedation and then get bloods and an examination. But actually what happened was when she was given, I think it was IM lorazepam, she actually got more agitated, I think as a result of people sort of pinning her to the chair and sticking a needle in her. So nothing again happened on that day either.
Yeah, it can be a real struggle to perform investigations on a patient that doesn't have any communication and doesn't have any understanding. And it can be very frightening for the patient and very frustrating for the doctor. So what we suggest is that as soon as the patient presents, get as much context as you can, as we've said. Look at their hospital passport, their GP records, whether they've got any specific care plans, whether they have anybody acting for them. And then get information from the patient, the family and the carers and the community learning disability team about any previous problems they've had, what's usual and unusual for the patient, whether they do have sensory or communication needs, whether they have any existing helpful support care plans like positive behaviour plans, and then what has helped the hospital experience in the past. You know, do they get less frightened if you take your mask off? Are they better if their teddy bear or their carer's there? Are they better if you give them relaxation techniques beforehand, etc.? And then if none of that works, then oral and sometimes intravenous sedation may be your only option.
Okay. So I then saw this lady for the first time on her third day in the hospital. And I think I was really fortunate because her sister was there. And again, that made me think about visiting hours, that we can be draconian sometimes. And thank goodness 2020 is behind us now, because that was very challenging for all sorts of reasons. But actually, relatives can be hugely helpful. So when I went to go and see this lady, she had a favourite dolly, but she also loved singing, and there were certain songs that she absolutely loved. So I asked the sister that question, you know, have they, has she ever had blood tests before? What happens? And she told us about this technique that if you sing to the dolly and also, you know, sort of tell the dolly what you're going to do, then it can really help. And it was like magic. We got bloods on her. It was lovely.
No, well done. Well, that just shows why it's so important to liaise with those patients who know the patient best. So well done you.
So I think it was more the sister than me, but yeah, it did feel quite satisfying. And I guess what I was thinking when I saw this lady, she'd lost a lot of weight. She was vomiting. She wasn't eating. She looked awful, to be honest. And she looked like some of our patients we see with terminal malignancies. And I was thinking, I wonder if this lady does have some sort of malignancy somewhere. And I was beginning in my own head to think about the benefit of investigations versus the risk and the harm and distress to her. But I just felt like we needed more information. But I thought, well, when her bloods come back, that might give me a good pointer. And they did come back, and it was a bit of a surprise, really, because pretty much everything was normal apart from her LFTs. And her ALK-FOS was over 1,000. Her ALT was a bit up. Her bilirubin was 29. Her gamma GT was nearly 2,000. So it was all pointing to quite a localized problem and a obstruction. And I was thinking, well, in this case, that's so reversible, because if she's got a gallstone sitting there, this is something that we could treat very easily. It's not like a metastatic cancer so we do need to do more investigations. So I spent quite a long time with her family discussing the fact that we're going to need a CT scan to diagnose her. And actually, the only way I could see that happening realistically is with a general anaesthetic, and how we would go about that. And I guess in this case, my assessment was I didn't think the lady herself had the capacity, but that's not always the case, is it, with patients with learning disabilities? So how do you address the capacity issue, really?
So patients with learning disabilities shouldn't be treated any differently to the baseline population with respect to capacity. So as with everyone else, they are assumed to have capacity unless it's established that they don't. And they don't just have capacity or not have capacity. They may have the capacity to decide whether they want tea or coffee, but not have the capacity to decide whether they have an appendectomy. So as with everybody else, the assessment of capacity should be time and decision specific. But it is important that you make reasonable adjustments to try and enhance the likelihood of them having capacity using available resources like Makaton, etc., or people that they know, and carefully documenting everything. Some of these patients do actually have advance directives or health wishes in their health passport. The family sometimes has a lasting power of attorney, so it's important to check that. And then occasionally, depending on how complicated it is, it may even require a court-appointed deputy or legal advice or an IMCA, the independent mental capacity advisor. But generally, the capacity assessment is done in the same way as for the baseline population, with very close involvement of the family. And if you're in an emergency situation, then common sense and duty of care apply to those.
Mm-hmm. So we all were in agreement that this lady needed a CT, but we also were all in agreement that she was getting a lot worse in hospital. So by this point, she'd had several days in hospital, was getting more and more agitated. And in my head, I was thinking, well, there's nothing that we're going to do now until we do a CT scan. She's just sitting in a bed. We're not giving her any fluids or anything. She's actually just about drinking enough to meet her needs. And so the family were desperately keen as well for her to go home. And it really helped them with sort of, because at the moment they were doing vigils. After I'd sort of seen them, I said, look, you can have open access to visiting. But then that meant they were doing vigils, which was very difficult for them as well. So we decided we could try and ambulate this lady. And it's a story of two halves, really, because the first thing we needed to do was the CT scan. So I remember emailing everybody and getting in touch with everybody. And we needed to coordinate anaesthetics. We needed to coordinate the radiology department. And I also needed somewhere for her to go in the morning so that she could have her pre-meds and then go and have the procedure and then come back while she was still a little bit drowsy after the general anaesthetic before she went home. And I sorted it all out and then I went on leave because the date they gave me was the following week and it just so happened that I was on annual leave. So it got a little bit messed up because radiology emailed me to say it was still going ahead because they got an out of office. They decided it wasn't. So the family all turned up and then the radiology department didn't have a slot anymore. Anaesthetics had turned up as well. And it was just very messy.
I was incredibly fortunate that there was a really good registrar on the shop floor that day who handled everything perfectly, actually. And I owe a big shout out to him for sorting that out.
Luckily, I wasn't actually out of area, so I came in and spoke to everybody. And she eventually got done at 4 o'clock on the emergency list. And I just felt like I'd completely messed up. And it wasn't a very nice experience. But she did ultimately have her CT, admittedly having a long day in hospital with a lot of very grumpy people. The net result of that was, though, she did actually have a huge gallstone, which was impacting. And so we arranged for her to have an ERCP under general anaesthetic. So again, she was already being ambulated, so we continued with that. And the biggest difference I made now was I contacted the learning disability team, which I'm a bit ashamed to say because I should have done that right from the very beginning. But it did feel a lot less lonely for me as a consultant trying to sort of coordinate this. And it just was another lot of people that were making sure she was okay. It took an awful long time. And that's the other thing that, on reflection, it was a huge amount of time. I think it was 34 days from the very initial presentation that she got her ERCP. In that time, she had a couple of attendances at the ambulatory care department where we just made sure her bloods were okay and that she was safe. And they were just about okay. And she was just about maintaining enough, certainly fluids. But you know, she was deteriorating and she was obviously in pain for all that time. But she had her ERCP, and that was a dream because the LD team were involved. They'd contacted everybody the day before. They met her at the hospital. They were with her throughout the sort of beginning bit of the procedure and after she'd had it. And off she went home. And after that awful experience of the CT fiasco, it was ironic because I was also on leave for this one. But the nice thing there was that the ERCP coordinator actually texted me as she'd got out of hospital after the procedure to say really successful. And then the next day I actually got a message from the sister with a photograph of her tucking into a roast chicken dinner, which was just brilliant. So there were so many things there that were great, but there were certainly a lot of things that I felt uncomfortable about. Certainly my learning points were that I needed to just involve the LD team immediately, and I think that would have helped the whole thing go a lot smoother. The wait time for both the CT and the ERCP just feel uncomfortably long. Now, I've actually looked at that, and if you don't have learning disability and you're waiting for an ERCP under general anaesthetic, it's a similar wait. So it's not that we were doing it any differently. It's just the fact it's more complex when you've got somebody who needs a GA. But still, I couldn't help feeling that if she'd been in hospital, the bed pressures and everything else, that would have been pushed forward. And sort of somebody who's a big advocate for ambulatory care, this is the sort of stuff we need to be able to do in ambulatory care, and we should be doing it quicker, I guess. Yeah, I think there's things that don't involve learning disabilities that I learned as well about sort of single-handedly trying to sort out these things and not getting all the resources that you need. So, yeah, any reflections from you on that case?
So it was a complex case, and I'm sure a lot of us will say that we've had similar experiences. I know I have. I mean, I had to arrange a CT head for a lady with learning disabilities who was non-verbal as an outpatient with GA, and I swear it took years off my life. But it's always easy retrospectively to say things that could have been done differently, but ultimately you got where you wanted, which is that you made a diagnosis, you treated her, and you got her better and kept her out of hospital. And it's always going to be a balance between keeping patients out of hospital, because particularly patients with learning disabilities are generally much happier at home and can find the whole hospital experience quite frightening, versus keeping them in to get things done more quickly. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that. I think a lot of it will depend on your hospital and your services, how quickly things would happen as an inpatient versus an outpatient. You've mentioned yourself the importance of getting the learning disability team involved. I tend to write it as my, you know, the first part of my plan, whether I'm clerking them or doing the post-take ward round, because they are a wealth of information, and somehow they get things done more quickly than you do. They probably have more power over the CT person than you do, etc. And they can provide support with respect to making reasonable adjustments and aid in communication, but also liaising with the family and being that helpful point of call. Mm-hmm. It was obviously difficult to get some of your tests right at the beginning. I note that it was kind of day three before you could get your blood tests. And it did seem to me like the patient was quite unwell when she first came in, in that she was vomiting and tachycardic and tachypneic. And the fact that she was agitated might suggest she was in pain, although you'd have to liaise with the family member as to how she normally shows discomfort. Oral promethazine, I see, didn't work, which is a shame because that's normally a good one.
I think she was on that normally.
She was on it normally, so probably not so helpful.
Yeah.
But again, trying to speak to the family as to the, you know, what's been tried in the past, or even speaking to them about the pros and cons of intravenous sedation to allow investigation. Now, it sounds a bit hardcore to give somebody intravenous sedation to get blood tests, but you know, it depends on the circumstances at the time, and if they really are unwell, that might be your only option. But as I say, you got there in the end with the singing technique, so well done.
I think the other thing, and again this is more applicable for a sort of a general life lesson, is that as consultants, when we're doing a ward round plan, the plan didn't work. but then nobody then revisits that plan until the next morning. And that's the thing, isn't it? It's sort of, well, if you make a plan, let's get some blood tests under sedation. If it doesn't work, can you let me know? Because we need to come up with a plan B. And that's just a general tip for consultants or people doing ward rounds, really. It's that the juniors will do their plan and it didn't work, and then they'll just wait for the next bit of senior advice. And that's where things like board rounds come in really useful, don't they? But it did feel like that, you know, the consultants were coming up with completely sensible plan, do this and then get some bloods, but then nothing until the following day.
I mean, on a more general note, there's an acronym that can be quite helpful. I know many of us have ways that we lay out our plans with respect to investigation, treatment, disposition, etc. And with patients with learning disabilities, there's an acronym called TEACH, which can be very helpful just to jog our memory as to what reasonable adjustments we could consider. So T is for time. So leaving enough time for the assessment, particularly on the ward round, it sometimes helps to see them at the end of the ward round when you've got more time. Sometimes if you've got quite a lot to explain, you might want to break it into sections and tell them some of it and then go back later and tell them the rest. You might want to schedule it so that the carer or someone from the learning disability team can be there at the same time as you. Mm-hmm. E is for environment. So some people with learning disabilities can get very overstimulated with respect to noise and lighting, etc. They might be happier in a side room if that's possible, obviously difficult with bed pressures at the moment. A is our attitude. I think you mentioned it earlier about thinking about whether they really do need 4-hourly observations and daily use in ease. You know, could you actually reduce it to alternate day blood tests, etc.? Could you have open visiting for that patient, particularly if it's helpful to them to have someone that they know next to the bedside? C is communication, which we've already spoken quite a lot about. And then H is help, which again, we've spoken a lot about getting people, including the learning disability team, involved.
Lovely. So I think we've discussed that case and it's brought up some nice sort of learning points. And I must admit, the first time I'd seen that TEACH acronym was in the toolkit. And for those who are not regular listeners, we do have show notes attached to each of these podcasts where we'll put links to all the various different things, and that will obviously be on there. So as usual, just go to the SAM website and in the Learning Hub, you'll find that there. So The only other thing that I really wanted to touch on, because I think it's so important, and it's interesting that we planned this podcast and then this happened to me in the last few days, is there was a patient with learning disabilities who was dying of a terminal malignancy, but didn't have a DNR in place. And when I asked sort of the people who'd seen them before, why not? They're like, oh, it's very difficult, isn't it, with people with learning disabilities. I don't want to be seen to judge. So, you know, I think there's a fear that people put DNRs in too easily, but likewise, then people get a little bit scared. So have you got any top tips for how we can approach that?
Yeah, so people get really nervous about this because they don't want to be seen to do the wrong thing. And actually, you just need to have the confidence that it's actually not any different to anybody else. So the decision to escalate care and the decision as to whether or not they are for resuscitation must never be made on the grounds that they have a learning disability. So even if they have what you perceive to be a very severe learning disability, where they're nonverbal and doubly incontinent and bedbound, those are not reasons to make them not for resuscitation, because we are not in a position to judge their quality of life. So actually, it's quite easy. And you need to think about other things, as you would with other patients, as to do they have comorbidities that are going to make it less likely that they'll survive? Is the investigation and the treatment going to improve their outcome or not? And so the same kind of things that go through our head with the baseline population should be how we approach patients with learning disabilities as well. And it's really important to have careful documentations, as with all our patients, around resuscitation and escalation of care. In Addenbrookes, we use the RESPECT form. Some people use the UPTO. And if you're finding it difficult to have these complicated discussions, the Royal College has a very good framework called Conversations for Ethically Complex Care, which is very helpful if you'd like some more advice on how to have these discussions.
I shall definitely put that in the show notes as well. That's great. Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I think this is such an important topic and one that we just need to discuss more and encourage more people to sort of look at the toolkit and really think about the little things that can make such a huge difference to the care of the patient. And if you're getting conceited and think, no, I'm absolutely fine doing it well, just look at those stark statistics that we talked about at the beginning. We aren't doing this well and there's a lot of room for improvement. Certainly from my point of view, through this podcast, I think my main take homes are what I'd learned before, which is definitely involve the LD team, because they are a massive source of resources and support. And they, you know, they've seen this time and time again, and they will come up with the top tips. And then I think you've just talked about seeing the patient at the end of the ward round. And, you know, we're getting increasingly busy, aren't we? Where it's really difficult. We're seeing so many patients. There's always a few more added on to the end of the ward round. And time is one thing that we often don't have. And I know that if I picked up a complex patient of any sort of any difficulty or any level of complexity, if it's at the beginning of the ward round, I start to panic about the other 20 patients or something I've got to then see. So actually, it's a good tip to say, right, okay, I'm going to do this at the end of the ward round, because I can have a cup of tea beforehand and really take the time, because that's what you need to do. So that's I really like that as a tip. Is there anything you'd like to end with, or any key points you'd like to summarise with?
If I had to just give one top tip, then it's extremely simple, but a simple phrase that I find useful at the beginning of a consultation, either to the patient or the next of kin, depending on the circumstances, is, I understand you have a learning disability. Is there anything that I can do to make the consultation easier for you? And I've started using that phrase since I was involved with the toolkit, and it's extraordinary how helpful it is. A lot of the time there isn't anything specifically that needs doing, but the patient and carers just look very grateful that I've asked. But sometimes there is. In my case, I often get asked to speak more slowly. Occasionally the patient is frightened of the face masks, etc., or the family says they don't really like stethoscopes, so maybe if you listen to their teddy bear's chest before theirs, that will calm them down. But just acknowledging it from the very, very beginning, even people with mild learning disabilities, I found to be really helpful.
That's a great tip. And I think we should end on that then, because it's such a great tip. Once again, thank you so much for your time. Reminder to everybody that you can find links to all the stuff that we've discussed on the show notes. Thanks for a great episode. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you. Thank you, Vicky.
Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website, www.acutemedicine.org.uk, for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You will also find more information about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod and let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd like us to explore in future episodes, or if you want to get involved, we'd love you to get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you can join us next time.